dead from lung cancer. Other points, and patients in the Markov model, it mimics a state of typically a day, a week, a month, a year, in which a patient's in one state. A randomization has occurred to see what state they wind up again. They could wind up in no disease state again or go to local recurrence, and then basically the dice are rolled again, like in Monte Carlo, and the state could change. This is our model, and it's very difficult to read, so I'll break it down. And this is actually a simplification. When we made this model, it was so big, and we tried to print it, that we took a wall of one of our offices from about there to about that picture frame there and printed out the entire model because it was so complicated and complex about all the different states that persons could derive in. So even what I'll show you, which is complicated, is a simplification of the model that we have. So the baseline state had a female with a recurrent UTI and was not treated. And then every day, we had our Markov model used a cycle of one day. The dice were rolled, and the patient would either have no urinary tract symptoms, which was the most common, most probable state, and there was a small chance that they'd have symptoms of a urinary tract infection. And if they had a urinary tract infection, we assume that they visited a physician, although you'll see later that that doesn't, some of the models skip that state. If the woman had urinary tract symptoms and visited a physician, there was a chance that they would have, when they have symptoms of a urinary tract infection, that they have symptoms of pyelonephritis. And we base that probability based on national data from billing codes of what percentage of UTIs are uncomplicated, meaning no pyelonephritis, or complicated, meaning pyelonephritis. So the probability was based upon that. If then again we looked at patients who had pyelonephritis, and then again based on national data, billing data, what proportion of them were treated as inpatients and outpatients. Exactly, in the Monte Carlo model, it adds for each patient, it adds up costs, it adds up health, quality adjusted life years or days in our case. And these would tick along. So inpatient treatment, we looked for data for what's the average inpatient treatment of pyelonephritis and used billing data, for example, that corresponded to that. If the patient had no pyelonephritis, we were very interested in costs, so we looked at laboratory costs for a big component of cost and whether your analyses were done or not, and there were some data suggesting how often these were done or patients were treated without laboratory confirmation. And if UTIs were present or absent, this was kind of a true state, since what's not said here is that some patients with urinary tract infection symptoms actually didn't have urinary tract infections, but had other conditions. And here is a similar branch tree, urinalysis either diagnosed or not diagnosed by laboratory testing. And there was a truth behind the accuracy of these tests, again, based on the literature. These are some of the examples of different symptoms of urinary tract infections that were non-UTIs, sexually transmitted infections, vaginitis. If the urinary tract infection was present, there was a probability based on the literature that it was cured. We assumed patients were treated with fluoroquinolone since they were the most commonly prescribed antibiotics. Or they were not cured, and if they were not cured, they would see a physician again where they might have pyelonephritis or no pyelonephritis. And again, treatment, if they had pyelonephritis, inpatient versus outpatient. Or if they had a UTI, not cured, so they're given antibiotics, not cured, and they persisted. There were other branches as to other alternatives, including outpatient antibiotics or prolonged courses of oral antibiotics. This branch tree is pretty similar to the one up above. And then after cure, patients would recycle back to their base state. And we assume that no one died in the model. The outcomes that were interested in our model were the number of urinary tract infections per year. We're also interested in cost. from the payer's perspective, and that's the health plan's perspective, costs from the patient's perspective. And we're interested in quality of life years, but since our model cycled in a daily fashion, we just divided that into quality-adjusted life days, which were qualities divided by 365, and then at the end of the year, added up the total to get a quality-adjusted life year.
Can you clarify the cost from the patient? Did you include, you mentioned earlier, work days lost?
We didn't. We didn't do that in the model. It was probably beyond our expertise and didn't attempt to do that. It's a good point. We used data version 4.0, their software. For systematic literature review, we were focusing, the purpose of this was to quantify the efficacy of the interventions that are in the literature and in terms of prevention of UTIs. So we looked at three databases, Medline or PubMed, Embase, and Cochrane Library. We searched for articles from 1966 to January of 2012. And our keyword strategy, we used the following words, recurrent, and we just basically used anything that word that began in recur. Urinary or urine, so just anything that began with U-R-I-N. And infectious or infection. So if they had all of these three keywords, that we would pull those articles. We also looked through the references of each of these articles to look for other studies that we might have missed via these search strategies. Because we knew we'd pull a large amount of articles and wanted to be very accurate in our estimates of the efficacy of these strategies, since no one really had attempted to synthesize the literature of how effective these strategies were relative to each other, we do this very systematically. We use two reviewers for each abstract poll, and we split it amongst three of us, and we basically looked at, after we did our PubMed, we came out with, you'll see, over 1,000 abstracts. They're read by, so each abstract was assigned two reviewers. If both believe the abstract might contain data on management strategies for recurrent UTIs, or a review article that might include references for these, that article was deemed to be polled. If reviewers differed as to whether they thought it was worth polling or not, then the third reviewer would be called in to tie break. And also, as I mentioned, we looked at the references to look for articles we may have missed by our keyword strategy. Because there are data on recurrent UTIs, we really wanted to focus on a specific population that represents the most common population affected by recurrent UTIs. So we only looked at studies related to adults. There's actually a pretty sizable pediatric literature as well. But these issues are a little bit different and relate to anatomic or abnormalities, and really you can't conceptually combine children pediatric literature largely with the adult literature. We chose a definition that's typically written in textbooks of what recurrent UTIs were. So the population under study had to have three or more UTIs per year. In fact, we found a lot of studies that had much less stringent criteria, and I think there was an article published a year or so ago on cranberry juice, and it was a negative study, but if you read the article, it was a population at very low risk for recurrent UTIs. Most of them had, it was just their initial presentation that they did have a history of recurrences, so that we included studies like that, it may bias our results because they're not done in the right population. We looked for a comparative clinical trial using either an untreated or placebo control group. We also used studies that were before after design, so pre-intervention and post-intervention UTI incidents, because if we restricted ourselves to these higher quality clinical trials, we'd be left with very, very little. And then since English is our language and we don't really speak, we just basically focused on English abstracts and or texts. So the probability of UTI prevention we obtained from reading the articles and then just compared, used the non-treated or placebo or pre-intervention group as the comparison group, and then the percent risk reduction in the intervention group. Since studies varied in size, we weighted the impact of that study by the sample size. So studies of women, of hundreds of women, would be weighed more than studies of women. Studies of prevention is, say, dozens of women. And then the other thing we did is we only used interventions in which two or more publications fit these criteria. There were a few prevention articles on a vaccine. There's vaccines and lactobacillus. There just weren't enough. There's only one study, and we felt it would be the robustness of the data for those interventions wasn't large enough to model. For a Monte Carlo simulation, we used hypothetical cohorts of 10,000 women, one-day Markov cycles. Our assumption was that women had a UTI rate in the untreated model of 3 UTIs per year. And then we did another one as a sensitivity analysis of sorts, in which we modeled 8 UTIs per year, just to see if the strength of the interventions on the outcomes of interest were any different in this other model. A lot of probabilities that weren't involved in the efficacy of the clinical trials were done by literature search. We calculated the risk reduction in a fairly straightforward way. I actually went through some of this in the model already, and the costs discussed. Other things related to the cost, we used data for costs from the American Hospital Association and assumed that a 10% cost of that would be placed on the patient. Physician visits were based on CMS reimbursement data. Pharmaceutical costs, how many people here have done cost studies? I'm curious. It was done on the Red Book, which I learned has limitations, which I'll mention. Which is, if you look at cost effectiveness or any sort of cost-based decision analysis, the typical way they measure pharmaceutical costs is using Red Book costs. Is almost universal, but when you really get into the fine details of how to use the Red Book, it is not nearly as straightforward as you think. We also assume that physician visits would incur co-pays. When it came to the complementary and alternative medications, those were a little more challenging to look at costs since they're very poorly standardized. We looked at 3 national commercial pharmacies that distribute widely and looked at prices on how much, when bought in bulk, that cranberry pills would cost, and used the mean for those 3 ones. Acupuncture we called third. It was very hard to determine the cost, so we used, we called 30 acupuncture clinics in metropolitan centers throughout the U.S. to ask them how much an individual treatment or a series of treatments would cost. Most of them thought we were kind of crazy for calling them, but we got that data. And then the lab costs, for example, of urine analysis and urine cultures were based on the mean of 2 major commercial labs. It was Quest and I forgot the other one. Health-related quality of life is difficult because there are no disease-specific measures, and I'm sure Ron can give plenty of comments on this, that we could find related to persons who had recurrent UTIs. So we relied on I'll get to that slide in a second. I got hidden. Just unhide it. Taken from the literature, we assumed that subjects would be in perfect health, and we used generic health states that were basically derived in the 1970s, find in articles by Kaplan, as to symptoms that most matched the symptoms of recurrent UTIs, for example, a urinary tract infection. The closest thing we could find was painful burning or frequent urination, but this was really done in a more generic population. In pyelonephritis, we used the closest thing which we could find was fever or chills with aching all over and vomiting or diarrhea. But obviously, these are more specifically from patient populations affected or exactly match the criteria a priori. We then did a slew of one-way sensitivity analyses and looked to see how it would affect our model. We basically did it for all variables that we modeled. Those include probability of different things occurring, like the effectiveness of each of the interventions, the chance a person would get cured when treated with a UTI that broke through. In the probability, the ranges were typically the lowest and the highest that we could find in the literature. If we could only find a single estimate or the estimates were pretty low, we usually took a very conservative approach. For example, for cost, if there was relatively, or some of the probabilities, we would just use a very wide range, typically half, we'd have and double the proportion of the probability. And the same with quality of life day, we did a very broad range of sensitivity analyses for that, just reflecting the fact that there's variation within each individual. Okay, so what did we find? So first, starting with our literature review, looking at the efficacy of these interventions, we reviewed over 2,500 abstracts and excluded a large number of them. Many of them, common things were non-UTI studies, pediatric studies, review articles or opinion pieces, basic science studies, case reports, etc., and wound up pulling 144 articles in total. Of those, we excluded most of them, again, typically review articles, opinion pieces. This should say metoferantoin. Study populations that have lower rates of UTIs, there was no untreated control group or pre-post comparison, pediatric studies in men, which is a whole other topic, epidemiologic studies, and basic science studies, and wound up with 20 articles on recurrent UTI management strategies. We were really left, when we looked at just the interventions that had two or more publications on the topic, we were really left with five, there's four here, with five strategies. Acupuncture, cranberry, daily antibiotics, and estrogen use. The fifth one not shown here, because it's really not a probability, is self-treatment. And there was more than one study on women self-managing their UTIs, but that in and of itself doesn't reduce risk of UTIs. Women who have three UTIs a day prior to self-managing are still going to have three UTIs a year when they're self-managing their infections. One problem we came across is that the variety of different antibiotics used in the literature for prevention of recurrent UTIs, and there was not enough information to show that one was better than the other. Therefore, we took the antibiotic that had the most data by far, and that was nitrofurantoin, and did not model other antibiotics and just chose that one as the as our measure of antibiotic efficacy. And what this probability means is basically a reduction in UTIs. So antibiotics would, based on our systematic review of the literature and pooling the available studies, would prevent 86% of UTIs, acupuncture 68%, cranberry 50%, and estrogen 65%. These were the ranges that we used in our sensitivity analyses and based basically on publications. Yes?
So almost every case, they're just using one of those strategies.
Yeah, it's a good point. I never actually even thought of it. I've actually never came across any study in which they did, cranberries plus antibiotics or something like that. That's a really good point. I'm sure that actually happens. in clinical practice all the time, but I could find no data on it. I won't bore you with some of these other probabilities, but this is just the rest of our probabilities in our table. You know, cure rate of breakthrough infections, 94%. Probability of a vaginal yeast infection, which I didn't show you in the model, after treatment with an antibiotic, it's 5%. We went through the literature, not in a systematic way, but in a non-systematic way, to look for these other probabilities, and only use the systematic search for the efficacy data. So, you know, probability of pyelonephritis if you present with a UTI, the chance that if you had a pyelonephritis that you'd be treated as an outpatient, for example, is 80% from what we could find. So this is our first outcome, and this is the number of urinary tract infections per year. And this is on the model that assumed that women would have a baseline rate of 3 urinary tract infections per year. You can see here on the far right that symptomatic self-treatment, when you model it, still came out to be 3 UTIs a year because there was no intervention, just a change in management. And the number of UTIs on an annual basis, based on our systematic literature review, you go from 3 to 0.4 with daily antibiotics, 1.1 with estrogen, cranberry pills, and 0.7 with acupuncture. Cost to the payer or health plan, and this is just for disease-specific costs, would be about $771 for UTI-related management if no strategy. Daily antibiotics added some cost. Estrogen actually, and cranberry pills decreased the cost, as did acupuncture and symptomatic self-treatment. Some of the costs in symptomatic self-treatment, the savings were related to not visiting physicians. And probably one of the main reasons why antibiotics cost a little bit more is that the health plan would be paying for some of the pharmaceutical costs, whereas for the complementary and alternative medicine, in our model, we assume that the patient would bear a lot of the costs. Typically, cranberry pills would not be reimbursed by health plans, and acupuncture, although it's changing, is typically not reimbursed by most health plans.
So is there an understanding of how acupuncture is working?
From a conceptual basis?
Or is it just speculation?
It's speculation. I mean, must admit, and I think I have the limitations, that the data on acupuncture is really from the same geographic, they're both Swedish studies from overlapping study groups. And, you know, we set up our rules a priori. One could really criticize whether we even should put that in our study, given it's unclear how, you know, we called some places and asked for costs and they had no idea what we're talking about, even some places using acupuncture for UTI. So this assumes that the practitioner would be like in the Swedish studies, know what they're doing, and experienced in this, and assuming you know, obviously believe their studies. I mean, there's some data for acupuncture for other conditions. I was actually surprised we found more than one study on this intervention. But this, you know, probably subject to a potential publication bias and other things. This is just another way of looking at the same data. From the payer's perspective, what costs would be, and daily antibiotics were a relatively trivial cost of $50 per year, and all the rest of the interventions would be cost savings, largely based on the decreased amount of visits to physicians, laboratory tests, and, medication costs for preventing UTIs. This is quality just of life days per year. If no strategy was used, baseline or model estimate 353, basically all these increases in quality adjusted life days in the first four groups were related to the decreased number of urinary tract infections that the population experienced. The symptomatic self-treatment group got a small boost, largely to not having to visit physicians and having us increased lead time to treating the UTI, so less days of symptoms by self-treating and avoiding a delay going to a physician or calling a physician. She just mentioned the model. When the physician costs, we assume the patients saw a physician, but we know that some patients will just call their physician to get a prescription. So in our range or sensitivity analysis, we range the cost down to zero for the cost and time of a physician visit. This is actually just another way of looking at the same data. I won't go through all these slides, but this is our other model of sensitivity analysis for the 8 UTI a year model, and largely the results were very similar to that of the 3 UTI a year model in terms of how the behaviors fared. I don't think there's really anything substantially different. So we did many, many sensitivity analyses. We had many, many, many model assumptions. Payer costs, we found that payer costs are very sensitive to estrogen costs, and the cost per day, when you looked at the red book for different estrogen products, was the range was enormous, going from 14 cents to $32 per day, depending on the preparation. And one thing mentioned, when you model, there were actually many estrogen studies, the different estrogen preparations were vaginal, suppository vaginal estrogen pessaries, oral estrogens. There are many different delivery systems for these drugs, and the costs of these would therefore vary quite dramatically. So if the estrogen was, you assumed it was really cheap, the payer cost would be a lot less. If it was quite expensive, the cost to the payer were substantially more. Antibiotic prophylaxis, for similar reasons, based on our ranges, the antibiotics were cheap, would result in a 43% reduction compared to what we estimated. Or if the antibiotics were quite expensive, there could be an 89% increase based on what we estimated. I can't go through every single permutation of our sensitivity analysis, but I went through basically the ones that seem to have the relatively large impacts. Most of the other costs had a relatively small impact. In terms of patient costs, the costs were very, very susceptible really to the complementary and alternative medicine interventions of the cranberry pills. If they were very cheap, it was much less expensive for the patient. If they're expensive, obviously more cost more, and the same with acupuncture. The other costs, such as co-pays, physician visits, the model was much more robust to a lot of the other cost assumptions that we modeled. Antibiotic prophylaxis, the efficacy of antibiotic prophylaxis is quite large because it had the largest number of studies that we used, went everywhere from 100% effective to about two-thirds effective, and that had a big influence on our results. We used the edges ranges. The chance of pyelonephritis, which we had to really infer based on lots of publicly available data, had a lot of influence on payer costs, anywhere from a 23% decrease to what we found to a 346 increase, depending on what value we used in our model. And then, interestingly, the quality adjusted life days was heavily dependent on the chance that a woman who had a breakthrough UTI was cured with a fluoroquinolone. In other words, when persons broke through with their UTI, if they weren't cured, that really affected their quality of life for every failure that occurred in the model or breakthrough. that had a big impact on quality adjusted life days. Sorry for the striptease thing. So just to summarize what we found for each intervention strategy. Daily antibiotics were the least effective and least expensive for patients, probably because UTIs were decreased overall, and the costs of their intervention were pharmaceuticals that were subsidized by their health plan. For the payer, it actually cost a nominal amount of money, $50 per year, but if you're in the 8 UTI model, it actually was cost savings to give antibiotics. As I mentioned, that the cost for UTI, 3 UTI model is relatively modest. Acupuncture was the least expensive for the payer, since we assumed that the patient would bear the expenses. But there's much unknown about this. Access to treatment is relatively unclear. I mean, if you live in a rural area and really want acupuncture for your recurrent UTIs, you're probably going to have difficulty accessing, or if there's no expertise locally. The efficacy of the intervention is poorly understood, again, based on 2 studies done from an overlapping research group in Sweden, and the applicability to other locations, populations, et cetera, is very clear. And the quality of these clinical trials, they're placebo-controlled, and the control group is no acupuncture, so which leads to wonder if there's some sort of placebo effect as opposed to some studies of acupuncture, which one of the control groups is a sham acupuncture arm. And the ideal regimen is uncleared. In the studies, acupuncture was administered twice a week for 4 weeks, and then women were followed for 6 months. It's unclear when we model it if this would have to be repeated after 6 months, if there's a more sustained effect, or so we just assumed in our model that this was done twice over the course of a year, 6 months apart. But again, the ideal way to use this intervention is unclear. Daily estrogens and cranberry performed very similarly in our model, with similar reductions in UTIs down from 3 to 1.1. Interestingly, the payer costs and quality adjusted life years gained were similar. The difference between the two is cranberry, from a patient's perspective, was expensive, since health plans typically don't cover it. So I mentioned some of the limitations of estrogens. The optimal delivery method is unclear. There's a variety of preparations. And there's also a lot of data showing that a lot of women cannot tolerate different estrogen preparations, especially systemic ones. And finally, symptomatic self-treatment didn't reduce UTIs, had very minimal improvement in quality of life years, but was extremely cost-effective to both the patient and provider. Obviously, maybe attractive to some persons, which I'll touch on in the very end. I could sit here for probably a day and tell you all the limitations of our model, because the more you begin to model things, the more you realize that you're making tons and tons of assumptions, which are probably just multiplicative, could potentially lead us astray in terms of what our conclusions, our findings, and summary and implications of our study is. But I'll just go through some of them. Obviously, we're only doing this based on published data. There's probably a publication bias for many of these interventions. For negative studies, may not have been published in the peer-reviewed literature, which would make the efficacy of many of these interventions lower than we had estimated. The quality of some clinical trials, when you use metrics to measure the quality of clinical trials, like Jadad scores and other different ways of measuring quality of clinical trials, many of them, in fact, the majority of them, would score relatively poorly in terms of study design, how they describe their clinical trial, their population, their randomization scheme, etc. Rob?
I think you're going to say that in a second, but you said you weighted by the size of the sample, right?
Right.
So was that correlated with quality? Or?
Actually, we didn't look at that. How would you do it? Would you
I just wondered because, you know, that would be another thing that varies whether you, how much you leave it.
Yeah, actually, I never thought of it at the time. But have you seen studies where they've modeled more heavily studies with higher clinical trials?
With quality?
Yeah. Based on quality?
Yeah.
And how would you do? How is that done?
Using one of those metrics.
Right. So they just, you know, if the score was like a 7 on the Jadot scale.
Yeah, sort of arbitrary exactly how much you weighed, but that's always the case.
Right. It would get 7 times the weight compared to a 3 on that scale or something like that. It's actually never come across that. Double-blind, placebo-controlled randomized clinical trials are ideal, but in this field, they're quite rare. The cost of the medications was something that we were really surprised how difficult it was. And, you know, when you look at cost-effectiveness studies, they just quote the Red Book, and we had a hard time getting it and finally got our hands on the Red Book. And notice a lot of limitations. For example, if you're looking at antibiotics like nitrofurantoin, the costs vary widely depending on the manufacturer. So many, for example, generic drugs often had a half a dozen or more different manufacturers whose prices would vary substantially. Then it was based also on the quantity that you purchased. So the purchase, so you know, if you bought 500 pills, it would come out cheaper. In our model, we just assume you bought in the highest quality bulk because that's what a health plan would do. But then when you really got into it and we talked to some more people to try to get information as to how they chose those, also these are just the published sort of data in which they're the generic manufacturer happy to release. And they're probably negotiated prices of these drugs when they're bought in extremely large quantities that they don't want to publish because it would basically, you know, it's like poker is giving away your hand how much, how low you will go. So even in the generic, you know, in the generic costs were quite challenging because they could vary by 3-4-fold or more easily. We just figured that health plans would be wise and we just chose the largest quantity purchase at the lowest generic price. The other limitations is that there are so many potential permutations, especially of tolerability and adverse drug effects, that we couldn't model. For example, nitrofurantoin can cause rare pulmonary fibrosis, which can be devastating, and we didn't model that. Nevertheless, in previous studies, we used similar models, very rare but very costly events usually have very little impact on the overall cost because of their rarity. As I mentioned, the complementary alternative medicine strategies were poorly standardized. The cranberry pills are made, you know, they're made by individual companies. The effectiveness may be based on the specific strain of plant that they use as the basis of their manufacture and the amount of the effective compound that within cranberries that are believed to be the efficacious to have the efficacy at prevention of UTI, but the amount of those varies widely from one product to another. We have no disease-specific health-related quality of life measures for this state. And this model just assumes women of all ages, but recurrent UTIs are usually occur in two very different populations, typically young women and older postmenopausal women, and the efficacies of some of these interventions may be quite different in these different populations. And we assume that in our model that patients were in perfect health, but especially in older populations, many patients might also have a variety of comorbidities that would affect some of their outcomes related to health-related quality of life. And one thing I learned from doing a subsequent study with some colleagues at University of Pittsburgh related to MRSA, cost-related MRSA, is we didn't do credibility ranges, which are used in cost studies. So there are some strengths, and it wasn't all horrible. We looked at multiple outcomes, multiple perspectives. We did a systematic review of the literature, which I think contributes to our understanding of the efficacy of these interventions, which has never been done, and tried to compare them. the kind of this is the final slide. So conclusion is interventions to prevent urinary tract infections. The ones that are published tend to be generally efficacious, and when you compare them to other interventions, health-related interventions are relatively cost-effective, and almost all of them are cost-minimizing to health plans. And one of the purposes of this study that we did is really just to help patients and providers choose what sort of an intervention may be best for them. And if you know, a gynecologist, urologist, or infectious disease specialist with a woman with a recurrent UTI, we've basically laid out data relating to our understanding of how efficacious each of these strategies are in terms of prevention, what sort of costs they might expect, and just give a framework to having a thoughtful and evidence-based discussion as to what might be best for that individual patient. And at this point, this is an old 13th century medical textbook telling me how to diagnose a UTI. Mm-hmm. So at this point,
they're going to taste it.
He's expecting the color.
So, three questions. Number one is the risk of a second infection pretty constant over time after the first infection? Or is the risk of infection greater right after the first one?
Yeah. I don't know if I've come across articles that looked at it that way, but my sense is that it's greatest in the period following the initial UTI. Probably because it relates to UTIs, especially in younger women, are heavily behavior impacted.
So your model doesn't adjust for that,
right?
Second question is a woman who gets three infections this year going to be the same woman who gets three infections next year? How much stability is there?
My guess is there's a lot of variation, but it's poorly quantified.
So when you generate a strategy for a particular woman, you may not necessarily be doing the right thing for them. I mean, how long do you do the strategy for a woman?
Correct. That's a really good one. Well, we don't address that at all in this study. A lot of them, especially older women, are usually indefinitely, because in older women, a lot of the factors related to the recurrences don't change.
Right.
And have to do with anatomical issues, changes in flora that are very, very difficult to reverse, and the anatomical ones are just postmenopausal changes. In women, it's, urinate after sexual intercourse, wiping, there's a lot of the right direction, there's a lot of behavioral things that are more modifiable.
And the third question is, so since you don't see that you're an infectious disease doctor, mm-hmm. you probably don't get this question, but as a primary care doctor, we do.
Mm-hmm.
So it's too long of a conversation to show them the paper,
right.
Show them different outcomes. So what would you?
I think the bottom line is, if you're willing to take antibiotics, just how badly do these disrupt your life? If you're willing to take antibiotics on a daily basis, that may be something for you. If you're a busy person who just can't afford to do it, if it was me, I would do symptomatic self-treatment because I don't want the inconvenience of having to go see a doctor or even just calling in to getting a prescription, but it's not going to change the amount of UTIs you're going to get. Person has to be realistic. It doesn't prevent UTIs whatsoever. I think estrogens, in which there are, and the topic is starting to get beyond my grasp and probably much better in your grasp as a generalist, because one thing we didn't model is all the potential limitations of taking estrogens with DBTs, etc. So probably a topical preparation may be an alternative, because a lot of people don't want to take antibiotics. They've read bad things about them, and that may be something else to consider. I think the data from a subjective, and I have no data to prove this, but my sense is that the efficacy of cranberry juices or cranberry products are overestimated and probably subject to a very heavy publication price. But there's not enough studies to make a forest plot and quantify that.
Related to that, I think the acupuncture. Sure.
Mm-hmm.
In
say
your,
that.
In your inclusion, then, because you said they have to have at least two studies, right?
Right.
And you said those were correlated. So were there only two and they were correlated? The same.
They're correlated just in the overlap of authorship.
Oh, that's awesome.
And overlap with geography. They're both from Sweden. And I think the data is too limited on acupuncture. This has to be validated by other groups. I don't know what they're doing over in Stockholm. And it was another one of those before after studies, if I recall. I'm trying to remember that one. I think that one might have been a before after study. And as you mentioned, those are very weak study designs and subject to all, you know, things get better because things get better.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember. I can't remember off the top of my head if that one was randomized or before after.
Very good.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for having me back after all these years.
Thank you.
What?
Are you the triage expert in your group?
I learned just from, because I would get these students who come volunteers and I have no money to pay for them. So I got into this because I had no money to pay for them. I just had to purchase the software, and if they were volunteering their time and they were smart and good with computers, so I kind of learned with them. Most people who do these, though, now that I'm working with, there's this guy named Bruce Lee who does a lot of infectious disease modeling at the University of Pittsburgh. And he's leading a couple studies that I've been involved in, is that, you know, those who do it seriously do it in SAS, and there's a variety of macros and other programs.
This is what we did first. We used it in SAS, our Markov models.
And I worry sometimes of what's under the hood in this, that there could be mistakes that we have no idea.
You know, I mean, it's a pretty simple algorithm when it comes right down to it.
Although, one time, which made me lose a little faith in the software, another one which wasn't a Markov, but was just more of a plain decision analysis model, modeled and got some completely illogical results that made absolutely no sense. And we looked at the tree 7 million times, it was all fine, and then just started again from scratch, redid the model, and got things that made intuitive sense, which is rather scary.
Like glitch or programming error.
I don't know if it's a...
But do you think about that and all the other statistical analyses we do, and we assume the answer is right just because it roughly looks right, but...
I was thinking about checking because it's so complicated in these situations. It would be nice if you had a peer review process where at least everything could be kind of replicated using the software. And I don't think that's even routinely done, but you said the journal could require at least that you say all the input parameters are there sort of in a data set that someone can at least mess around with it.
Or just give the file itself if someone's interested.
To me, the main problem is the first order assumption that the rate of recurrence is constant over time, which for a cohort of women it's probably not true, and that there's a lot of variation. So a woman's going to be at risk for a period of time, and then they're going to drop off the map depending on their behaviors or whatever the underlying cause was in the first place that caused the recurrent UTI. So some of these strategies really depend on that risk being constant over a long period of time. And you could model that, and you could actually find data to support, well, what are the different patterns? Because there are some women who, as you say, the older women, probably are at a constant risk because the underlying causative factor is fixed.
Right.
Whereas for young women, it's not going to be. So modeling that would be, an alarm for varying underlying risk. So a second-order model, a Markov model, might be useful.
This very, very
as a nice place.
What's that? I'm always willing to learn.
Well, I mean, I think it would be a good follow-up paper. And focusing on younger women for, somehow incorporating behavior, if that's possible. So to see, because there's got to be the subgroup that you kind of refer to that don't behave, in the same way as other people, and so they're at greater risk. Mm-hmm. I mean, so it's outside of intervention, but I bet that you get a lot just out of that group. That isn't, what they're doing that's sort of making them higher risk or not doing. It would be interesting.
You could use all the data you've got. Mm-hmm. All you do is change the first order assumption about the underlying risk and how it changes over time.
Yeah, I just there was no pen.
Oh.
You can fill these out.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
You'll get a copy.
Can I borrow your pen?
Yeah.
There we go.
You'll get a copy of his purse.
Yeah, I was waiting for you to skewer me over the health related.
No, actually, that was not bad. That's about the best choice you could make.
Okay. Take care, Mitch.
Because acute UTI is dominated by symptoms, and it's probably going to give you the best estimate. of the effect and the magnitude that showed there seemed reasonable. So there aren't a lot of other options.
One thing that was interesting, I think, was I assumed there would be some hit in health-related quality of life for taking a medication daily, but there really wasn't.
Yeah. I mean, all you got was pain, of course, but that's probably the main thing, right, that's going on.
Yeah.
I thought it was interesting, but how about just buying cranberries or growing cranberries or something? There was an implication that they charge a lot for those pills.
Yes, they do.
That's crazy.
The amount of money they make on that stuff is enormous. Just go to I think we went to CVS, Walgreens, the three national chains, and just looked at the generic CVS brand cranberry pills.
Yeah.
And they're not cheap at all.
It's good business.
It's a good business, yes.
Bactrim is cheaper.
Bactrim is much cheaper than cranberry pills. I guess you could courier on unless they live in Arizona or something.
Thank you.
All right.
Appreciate Russ is actually probably the closest to the right content for this series. Because we really haven't been touching on cost effectiveness at all directly.
I'm kind of embarrassed because I'm always, half I learned as a student, and the other half I'm just kind of self-taught and talking with people.
Did you take Emmett's class? Or
yeah, I took Emmett's class. Yeah. Now I'm on a grant, it's a pretty small role, but it's related to modeling a variety of infectious diseases like MRSA and influenza. And there's some people who are very well experienced and big in their field, so I'm learning a lot from them as well.
Are you still doing adherence stuff?
I kind of fell out of that.
I know.
But I do one project with Hong Hu. Actually, two projects. His Mach 14.
That's what I was wondering.
And also, he's got an intervention at Harbor where patients get texts and other reminders and have access to